Coming up on this week's show, virtual reality comes to the N64.
A huge storage boost for your PSP Go.
And we chat low-tech games with Alistair Lowe.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every week with our incredible mates at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen their latest release? Everyone's so hyped for this. N64, a visual compendium. A rich history of the machine that marked the moment that Nintendo moved to fully embrace 3D. And of course, resulting in some of the best games ever made. So you can check out that and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our lovely mates at PCBWay. Now, of course, you know about PCBWay. If you're working on something at the moment and you want a fully featured custom PCB prototype, they've got you sorted. Low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and they offer services like 3D printing and injection molding. And, of course, they're massive supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote right now on their website at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 420, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And very nice to have you joining us for this week's podcast. Of course, a show that just before the weekend celebrates all things in the world of retro gaming and technology. And you guys feeling a bit nervous? I feel my picking on someone finger waving around again this week.
Oh, what is this? In it last week.
Oh, new approach to the podcast.
Yes, who's going to describe? I mean, imagine this, Ravi. I'm a new listener, right? I'm scrolling through Spotify. I'm like, oh, this podcast sounds interesting. The Retro Hour, Retro. What's this about?
I'd say it's kind of like Poundland, you know.
So give it the polished sell.
Not everything in Poundland costs a pound. Yes. You know, the Retro Hour goes on a lot longer than an hour.
I was wondering where you're going with that. I like that.
You like to yammer on a bit, if I'm honest, yeah.
Yeah, it's a podcast where we discuss the latest in old news, old technology news, but the kind of new adapters, new devices, new games coming out. But also we do an interview with an industry legend or developer or artist. And we've been doing it for, God, over 8 years now. And it's come out every single week, which is pretty crazy.
Exactly. So I think that kind of sums it up. That's what the podcast is about. And of course, we bring you up to speed on what's been happening in retro. Because we get that everyone's got busy lives. You know, not everyone can spend all day on the forums, on the socials, and kind of see what's happening in retro. So we keep an eye over all that for you and give you the big stories from the last week. And in terms of, you know, retro stuff that we do, not only do we do the podcast as well, I mean, you have a bit of a extracurricular activity as well as your day job as well, Ravi. I know you work for my favourite magazine, Amiga Addict. Now, you know, as a kid, I used to buy all the Amiga mags, you know, Amiga Format, CU Amiga every month. I'd get Amiga Shopper as well. All my pocket money were going to Amiga magazines. Amiga User International, Amiga Computing I get sometimes as well. So when you guys launched this new Amiga magazine a couple of years ago, I mean, I'm hyped for it every month when it comes through the letterbox. It really feels like, you know, being like 11, 12 years old again. We thought we'd give it a little mention, though, because we haven't mentioned Amiga Addict on the podcast for a while, but still going strong. What you guys been working on this month?
Yeah, so it's issue 28, and I've actually done the feature, which is like 6 pages, so it's been quite tough to do. And, you know, it's quite interesting because I used to do the features, and just with time, you know, doing the podcast, having a job, you know, all of this other stuff, it's quite hard to do. But I'm really happy to be back doing the feature for this issue. And that's on Scala, which is a beautiful piece of Amiga software. I kind of called it like a glue that brought all the different elements of Amiga together.
I do remember Scala. It was a bit like almost like a multimedia creation suite, wasn't it? I remember they used it for do you remember they had those there was like an exhibition, I think it was at the London Transport Museum back in the 90s. I remember reading that they basically repurposed Amiga CD32s running Scala for like interactive kiosks.
Yeah, they used it for everything. They actually used it to advertise Windows as well at one point. Oh, God. So, you know, Microsoft were using it. It's a really cool piece of powerful software. And in the magazine I go down the kind of rabbit hole because it was also used on cable TV, and then they even had some hardware themselves. So yeah, it's a really interesting read, and you can pick it up in W.H. Smith's as well.
Yeah, so if you're a fan of the Amiga, Amiga Addict magazine, definitely worth getting a hold of. I look forward to it every month as well. So it's going to be interesting to read more about Scala. I remember using Scala actually for, I think it was like scrolling credits on videos that we'd make at school. I bring my Amiga 500 in, probably with a hooky copy of it.
Yeah. Producer Dan Wood, editor Dan Wood.
So, yeah, definitely worth looking out for that. And on the podcast this week as well, I mean, one thing that we have been focusing quite heavily on over the last couple of months on the podcast is the indie scene, because in terms of retro gaming and indie, now they really do go hand in hand, as we've said a couple of times now. And it really feels like at the moment that is kind of where some of the most exciting activity in the retro world is going on at the moment. And today's interview is kind of a bit of a follow-up to the chat we did with John Riggs a couple of weeks ago, because he collaborated with our guest this week, and you met them both at that Indie Awards that you went to in Nottingham about a month ago. And this is Alistair Lowe from Low Tech Games. Now, you might be familiar with Alistair because he makes some really innovative games, particularly for the NES and the Dreamcast, including a game that's been a massive hit over the last couple of years, Flea, on the Nintendo Entertainment System.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, you know, we've had even Spectrum Next developers on and stuff, yeah, and they've talked about how these areas, like these older systems, have been the kind of experimentation ground for indie games, and then they go out and they get ported onto, you know, the Xbox and the PS5 and Steam and stuff like that. Well, Alistair's games are really interesting. So he started doing stuff on the NES. Well, originally he did mobile games, but he started on the NES, and he's not really a coder, so he used a NES Maker.
Is that kind of like a dev kit then, isn't it? We'll hear more about that with Alistair, obviously, but it's kind of like, yeah, but basically a homebrew development kit for the NES, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of like things that enable people to create their own games and their own kind of ideas that, you know, they wouldn't have been able to use back in the days. It would have been a lot harder to kind of create something. But now, using, you know, modern hardware, you can kind of make it a lot easier and develop and design your own game. And he's kind of helped with that as well. So there's a emulator, which was for the NES, and it was on the Dreamcast. And it's open source, and they've kind of updated that as well. So the porting process from the NES to the Dreamcast is something that we talk about in this, but also Tapeworm, which is another game that he's created, Flea 2 as well, which is going to come out on the NES. And these are,
that's running on Kickstarter now, actually, Flea 2, isn't it? Which we'll link in the show notes if people want to check that out.
Yeah. Yeah. And these are proper releases. You know, you're getting carts here, and there's some absolute banging soundtracks. It's a really nice kind of concept of having parasites, as you know, creatures within games.
That's changed quite a bit since back in the day. You remember there was that era in like the early 90s where everything was like a cute, fluffy, cuddly little mascot. Now it seems like, yeah, like you said, parasites.
Tapeworm.
Seem to be quite a big thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And
not quite as adorable.
He did a Choo Choo Mimic with Rigged Games, which was John Riggs as well. But he's also done some really interesting stuff on his own. So he did a whole prank about Doom running on Cross Stitch. Which was just
that video
mad.
Blew up, didn't it? Yeah, went
yeah, yeah. You know, went into the millions with that, and then he's also done a game on a pop-up book, which is kind of hard to describe in the podcast, but we'll have it in the show notes. But it's a pop-up book where you open the pages, there's a projector on it, and then you can kind of play each page, and it's like a really nice concept of, you know, bringing physicality to the kind of video game world, and something that parents can play with their kids.
Yeah, so really interesting guy this week, Alistair Lowe from Low Tech Games, particularly if you're into the, I keep alternating my pronunciation of this, the NES, the NES, because whenever we say NES, inevitably we get like, you know, tweets or comments from American listeners going, what's that? NES? What are you saying there? NES, as they say, that's had the pond. But yeah, I mean, massive indie developer this week. If you love Flea, and you want to hear more about Flea 2, that, like we said, is running on Kickstarter right now. All of that coming up with Alistair Lowe, our special guest, in around half an hour from now. Now, of course, we did say first half of the podcast, that's when we chat about the news, a little roundtable discussion about what's been happening, what's been going down in the world of retro from over the last week. And this is a headline I didn't expect to see. Virtual reality is coming to the N64 because why the heck not, as this article says.
Why the heck not? This is by James Lambert, who made the awesome Portal 64 fan project, which actually sadly got closed down in January of this year. We were covering for quite a while. We, you know, mentioned it on the show a few times, and the things this guy's doing with the N64, absolutely insane. But yeah,
he's not been disheartened about that, has he? He's continued. He's keeping going on the N64 vibe.
He's just going to keep it going. Obviously a huge N64 fan. He's got a wicked YouTube channel, which I really like, because of, even though he does kind of go into the technical side of it, he keeps it quite simple as well for like the likes of myself, which I love. And the idea behind this was, he has a modded N64, which has a USB port in it and also a HDMI port in it from, you know, previous projects, such as the Portal 64 project. So he thought, well, why not hook my Oculus development kit that he got, which is just gathering dust in his cupboard because he's a big fan of VR, he mentions in the video. And when the Oculus came out, the Oculus One development kit, he's not really used it until now.
And from that's what a familiar story, isn't it? Getting an Oculus and not using it, Jim. Like us.
A little bit like us, yeah.
Dan's probably got a dev kit in his cupboard.
Yeah, more than likely.
I forgot about.
But from what I understand, to get this kind of running through his N64, he hasn't had to do too much to it. I'm sure it's not as simple as he makes it look. You know, he just kind of plugs it in and it works. And obviously, it's not like, oh, it just works in Ocarina of Time or it just works in GoldenEye. He's had to reach out to another developer who is known as a Pyroxene, I think you say it, Pyroxene or something like that. And he's a 3D artist who was going to help him with the previously cancelled Portal 64, but he's developed like a level, like a world for him to kind of run around in on this virtual reality N64. But it looks pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think in terms of this running on a system that's like up 25 odd years old now, this looks really impressive. And like you said, he's used this Oculus Developer Kit 1. He said, you know, basically it's got a very simple tracking and interface on there as well. He takes the output from his modded N64 via USB as well. Some interesting things that he's working on. He said there is a little bit of kind of lag on there as well, and the head movements don't quite catch up. But apparently he's planning on using an Arduino maybe to help with that, you know, to send the orientation data back to the N64, which might smooth things out a little bit. Obviously, they're having to render separate vision, split vision for each eye as well, which obviously putting more strain on the system, giving it that stereoscopic 3D, I think they call it.
Well, I think he's going to have to work with a way of hooking up the actual controls. So, like, you know, if you were in, like, Mario 64 or something, you know, you'd be going up on the controller to look up and then kind of having that hooked up with the Oculus. There needs to be like a communication layer in there, and that's probably why he's running the custom software. But it's quite funny, at the end he has a power glove as well. I think that might be an attempt at getting a kind of control device in there, but it does seem a bit kind of sketchy. Maybe, you know, that's why he's using that 3D pre-made environment there.
Wouldn't it be amazing if the Power Glove turned out to be like the ultimate VR controller?
Imagine. I really don't think it will.
It's the dream, isn't it? You
know? Suddenly they become really in demand and that's it. It's kind of been, you know, vindicated after all these years of slagging it off.
So I guess in theory then you could put, I don't know, you could put anything through this VR, like if you had a custom piece of software, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's just HDMI in and USB, I guess. You just send the data to it.
Yeah, if you had the output of anything into HDMI, you know.
But I think it's very cool that he's done this for the N64, and he's saying, I mean, obviously this is really a work in progress at the moment, and he's making steps to get this smoothed out. And he's got, you know, if you watch the video, he is looking around, the accelerometer in there is working, it can determine the headset's orientation, you know, stuff is moving. Like we said, there is a bit of lag that hopefully the Arduino will sort out as well. Like you said, Ravi, obviously probably needs some way to really get the control optimized for VR. But I think looking at this video, he's not planning on basically, you know, like you said, turning Super Mario 64 into VR. I think they're going to be making their own original N64 VR game by the sounds of it. Because obviously, I mean, he's got his chops working on that Portal port that got cancelled. So I think, you know, having something new that he could work on that was, you know, targeted towards this would be very cool. Obviously a very niche market, because you're going to need somebody who's not only got the Oculus, also a modded N64 and has this game as well and is interested in VR. I'm not sure kind of how big that market is.
Just GoldenEye VR, come on.
You know? GoldenEye VR, I mean, it'd be a hell of a setup. It's a type of, like you say, Rabbit.
Four in your connector.
I imagine Dan would be able to set up. But yeah, have all that custom software and then the custom N64 as well on top of that.
I think there is actually a GoldenEye VR Oculus kind of tribute, but it would be cool to see.
I mean, retro VR, it always sounds a good idea in principle. I mean, obviously he's using a more modern headset for this, which I think will definitely help. So I did buy, you guys might remember, God, it must have been about 2 years ago, I bought kind of a third-party virtual reality headset from Japan that was basically what was left of the Atari Jaguar VR's hardware that they sold to this third-party company. It's in the other room, I can't remember who makes it. But basically it's got composite input in there and you can output the Atari Jaguar's video hardware, you know, the video output into it, right, or basically anything that uses, you know, the standard composite video. But there is one game on the Atari Jaguar, Missile Command, that was made for VR. Sadly, it can't do the head tracking and everything, but I did try plugging it in just to see what it looks like. And my God, I thought I was going to vomit after about 10 seconds. It was, you know, even modern VR, if I'm playing like PSVR and I'm playing racing games and stuff, it might just be me. I don't know if you guys are the same. I do get quite affected by motion sickness in VR.
I think the best one that I saw with the VR stuff was, I know they had that platform one, which was like kind of 2.5D. Like it stuck out a bit. And you'd play like Donkey Kong on there and stuff. But I always enjoyed the ones where you're actually in an arcade and you're walking around an arcade and then you find a game and kind of go into that in VR.
More like environments and stuff than playing the actual games, But I mean, that's the thing. I mean, obviously it's using more recent hardware, so I imagine it'll look a lot better than, using a 90s virtual reality headset. But yeah, very cool to see. Like I said, very niche audience there, but I think just having virtual reality running on the N64 is something very cool indeed. So we'll keep an eye on that. If you want to check out the video and the work in progress so far, I will link that up in the show notes at theretrohour.com or check your podcast app. And of course, over the weekend on Sunday, it was Mother's Day here in the UK. But we weren't celebrating that, were we? Instead, it was Mario Day.
It was Mario Day.
Yeah, we did both, yeah. Don't want to get you in the bad books with the Mrs. Joe. they did time this, actually. Nintendo were quite good about this, because even though it was Mario Day, M-A-R-10-Day, Mario Day, on Sunday, they did release the major announcement on Saturday night, so they didn't take the shine off Mother's Day here in the UK. But the big announcement is there's going to be, and we kind of talk about these quite a bit, even though I don't think any of us actually own any of them so far, there's going to be another retro Lego kit this time.
You're assuming there that mums are not Mario fans.
Well, yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
My mum doesn't mind a bit of Mario Kart.
She might have been excited.
Well,
might have been the best gift.
Yeah, this could be a Mother's Day present for you next year, because this is coming out in 2025. This is a Lego Mario Kart set.
Yeah, so all they've put is, I love how we're like, this is the biggest announcement other than the fact that they've announced the next Mario film and loads of other releases of like Luigi's Mansion 2 and Paper Mario, but we're going to talk about Mario Kart Lego. Yeah, they've announced the Mario Kart Lego for 2025, and it is literally just Mario Kart Lego 2025. That is all they've announced, like on the advert, and you just hear like some sound effects from Mario Kart. Now, I'm interested to get your guys' opinion on this. Like, do you think it is literally just going to be a Mario Kart set, like, of Lego? Or do you think it's going to be, like, a Ski Electrics? Or do you think it's going to be, like, Mario Kart Home Live, Home Circuit? You know what they did a couple of years ago, where it's, like, an actual remote control car and it's a game, but you have to build it out of Lego?
I would want an entire Rainbow Road. I can imagine that would be so expensive.
That would be so cool, though.
That's the thing. I mean, these sets are generally quite expensive anyway. We talked about that when they release these Lego sets. The price of Lego now is like nuts. But it would be cool if, imagine like a... Because that didn't even cross my mind, that it could be actual playable game. Mm. I just thought it might be like, you know, a few of the characters in the carts and stuff that you'd kind of put on a shelf and it'd look pretty. But now I'm getting quite excited about that. It's like a Ski Electric style Mario Kart thing that you could play with mates. Wow.
Well, or if they did the little carts, like, you know, just the iconic ones and... like the baby pram as well and stuff like that. You know, they had all the different designs, and then you got the Mega Bloks Road for cheap. Or you can probably make, if you had enough spare bits of Lego, you could probably make your own Rainbow Road set, couldn't you?
Yeah, true, true. I mean, they have done a Mario Kart Scalextrics before, but it is just, it's Scalextrics. It's nothing, it's not Lego. You don't have to, like, obviously you do build the track and you then put the little plastic cars on it, but I think it might be something like that. Like, similar to what Ravi said, I think there might be a bit of a road that you build, maybe a bit of a Rainbow Road, and then you will have the cars that you build yourself. But I think if they really, really wanted to go for it, they could do the Mario Kart Home Live thing with it and make it like augment reality on your phone and stuff.
Yeah, because that's the thing I'm thinking. If it was Lego, how would you, like, you know, drop a banana or fire the blue shells and stuff? Because that's a big part of Mario Kart, isn't it? You know, you need that.
I'm probably over fantasizing, and it probably is just going to be a Lego set that you put.
You're going to be heartbroken next year, Jay.
Yeah, but I think if they really went for it, they could make a little remote control car that you build yourself out of Lego, and it's got a little motor in there and stuff, and you build on top of it, like a little bit like Lego Technics, I think it was called, or Lego Techno or something, I think it was called in the 90s. I think that would be really cool, but I think I'm reaching for the stars a little bit there.
You know, this conversation reminds me of the kind of conversations you'd have with your mates in the playground when you were a kid. Yeah. It's going to have flying cars in it. It's going to have all sorts. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, you go around to two houses when you were kids. One house where all the Lego sets were made nicely and they had all of them matching up, and another one where you had like flower pots on spaceships and stuff like that.
Just a big bucket of Lego.
Yeah, I'd just dive in. Yeah.
Every set was mixed together.
Yeah, so it's very cool to see that coming out. And there's going to be more Lego sets that are coming up in 2025 as well. There's going to be a King Boo's Haunted Mansion for Lego Luigi to explore, which looks very interesting. And also there's going to be a Bowser's Express train set as well, which, looks like they're doing quite a bit.
I just can't wait to see Lego Manhunt. That
Lego GTA. Yeah, that would be wicked. But yeah, no, lots of Lego stuff for Mario. And then also a couple of the classic Game Boy Mario games coming out this week to the Switch as well. Dr. Mario, Mario Golf, and Mario Tennis, all Game Boy games, which is pretty cool seeing them coming out on the 12th of March.
It makes me realise there's so many Mario games. I mean, a lot of those Game Boy games, I didn't have a Game Boy back in the day, so I've never played Mario Golf, never played Mario Tennis. I played Dr. Mario. Yeah, which is great, great puzzle game. I do like that one. But yeah, it's just like you forget how many Mario games have come out.
Yeah, and it's not all these games have come out recently. There's just Mario games everywhere. You are right. Like you think of like, oh, Mario World, Mario Brothers 3, etc. But then you think like, oh my God, there was so many different Game Boy game variations, and I was going to say Game Gear games as well. That would have been weird. But there were so many other games that I think a lot of us forget about, you know, even right through, well, until now, but even on the GameCube, there was, you know, Mario Tennis, Mario Golf, Mario Party Dance Mix, Mario Soccer, Mario Baseball. He's been everywhere for like 40 years.
Yeah. Well, he's been around a long time, like you said. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. Look forward to a bit of Dr. Mario session this Saturday. Now, talking about handhelds, the PSP Go, which is actually a system that I'd forgotten about, because, this was kind of in that kind of era between the PSP and the PS Vita, wasn't it? Very short-lived, digital-only PSP, which you think about that. I mean, when did this come out? Was this like 2009? Yeah, which was very early for... I mean, people now, that they're talking about digital-only systems becoming a thing. But the fact that Sony were doing this, like, you know, over a decade ago, is quite crazy to think of as well. But now the PSP Go is getting a bit of love, and it turns out that if you want to get some games on there... There's now going to be not quite a simple way, but a homebrew way of giving your PSP Go a bit of a storage boost.
Yeah, so the PSP Go, I actually remember when it came out.
It's very pretty, isn't it?
It's pretty. At the time, I didn't like it. You know, it looks like a phone. You know, it looked like a Samsung phone. You know, you flip it up kind of thing. Yeah. But now I think they look quite sleek. And I remember my friend bought one. And I was like, why have you spent so much extra money on getting the PSP Go? You can't store games on it. And he's like, oh, well, it comes with 16 gig data, 16 gig hard drive. And that's what they came with. They shipped with either 16 gig memory or 32 gig memory. And, you know, I remember, you know, oh, it's going to fill it up so quick and everything like that. But this mod enhances it to 128 gigabytes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it was like this proprietary memory stick, M2, which seems really expensive. So this mod is kind of just adapting it for microSD storage. But there are a few problems with it as well. Like, you know, obviously data is going to read slower. It's not going to be as fast, and it's a bit fragile. But, you know, I had a PSP. I don't know what the modding's like on the PSP Go, but the PSP, it's awesome, like absolutely amazing. And I assume it's kind of the same. Like, if you want a great emulation machine, PSP or Vita as well, they're a really good way to go to, you know, have a lot of your older systems on something portable that's widely available. I think the Go's are a bit more expensive, though, from what I've seen, buying them secondhand.
Yeah, they're probably a rarer system. I think they're only on the market for about 18 months, weren't they?
Yeah, literally. It was 2009 to 2011 before they said they were shifting focus to the PS Vita, which makes sense. And I always feel the Vita was newer than that. Like, but no, 2011.
That's been and gone as well.
yeah, exactly. But this mod, I don't know, it doesn't look like you have to solder anything. It just looks like you kind of take the PSP apart, take the shell off, and you just kind of stick it down, maybe. I'm not too sure. Do.
Yeah, basically you've got to apparently trim some plastic support tabs inside it to fit it in, and then so you can reinstall the backplate on it. It's a very small adapter. I mean, you imagine the size of a standard SD card. It's maybe like two or three times the size of that. It kind of snakes around at an angle. Yeah, basically it just kind of plugs into the ribbon connector inside the PSP by the looks of it. Apparently you've got to hold it down with some sticky tape because it can come loose. It does seem like it's a little bit fragile. But I mean, for the cost of it, you know, like we said, it can bump your storage up to 128 gigabytes. They're selling these for $12.99.
That's great. And
yeah,
it didn't have a UMD drive, did it? So
well, this one didn't know.
No, the PSP goes. So that's what made it a lot thinner. And I remember the UMDs, people would do mods putting high capacity batteries in the PSP in the back of them, and, you know, being able to fit that because of the space from the UMD drive. But this requires a really thin solution to go in. And at that price, you're laughing, really.
Although, I mean, if you have got a PSP go, that is one downside. It means you can't watch Big Mama's House on UMD. Which, you know, I think it was a system seller for me back in the day.
You know, I sometimes go into like pawn shops and charity shops, and I see a few like lonely UMD discs, and it is usually like Big Mama's House or something like that.
40-year-old Virgin, I think I've got as well. I generally buy them off a season because I have got a PSP. I don't think I've ever watched a UMD movie on them, but
you just
buy them. Yeah, put them on the shelf. Same with my Philips CDI video CDs. Just a cool thing to own. So if you have got a PSP going, like you want to give it a new lease of life, then these are available now. Like I said, very affordable price. So I'll link that in the show notes as well. Now, speaking of very cool things, I'm reading this and I'm thinking, oh, wouldn't mind getting my my fishing rod out for my Dreamcast at some point again soon to have a little blast on Sega Bass Fishing. Although it turns out there was a port of it to the NES back in the day that is now readily available for anyone to download. I'd never heard of this before.
I love this. So in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was a Taiwanese company, and they were making games for the Famiclone. So, you know, Famicom, Japanese, Nintendo, kind of like unlicensed, you know, units, game consoles.
Unofficial
units they would make and sell in Taiwan. And there's been so many different, like, you know, kind of like unofficial ports to the NES of like Mortal Kombat. There was one for Tekken 2. There was one of the James Cameron 1997 Titanic game, which was a beat 'em up, which was absolutely fantastic. Let me find the name of this company.
Hummer Team, apparently.
You know, other regions where titles come out from.
Hummer Team. Yeah, Hummer Team. There we go. So all unofficial. And as it turns out, I didn't know about this one. In the early 2000s, they had made a Sega Bass Fishing one as well, which worked with one of these Famicom clones, which came with an unofficial fishing rod as well for it. Now, reason we're talking about that is this week is a ex-user called Pirate Game Thing has actually dumped the game online. So I'm assuming he's actually got one of these kits, one of these, you know, cartridges with this game on from Taiwan, on one of these Famicom clones. And they do work on the Famicom as well, and you can get them to work on the NES and stuff. And he's dumped this fake Sega Bass Fishing, the Hummer Team's version that came out in the early 2000s for the NES. I don't know about you guys, but I think this is wicked. I really the look at this.
I'm looking at, when you first sent this story over, I was like, God, I bet this is going to be dreadful. I was picturing kind of those, you know, you go down like to Skegness in the summer, you'd buy those like off the market, those kind of cheap NES kind of clone systems, and they'd have some kind of homebrew games on there or ripoffs. They're always dreadful. But then I'm watching the video of this, and actually, it's got like parallax scrolling. It's got the color palette is amazing. The characters look really well drawn. This looks like a really good playable fishing game.
It's a really playable fishing game. It's got fantastic graphics for the NES, a really good soundtrack. You know, the premise of it, obviously it's fishing, but you know, you can pick your lure, you can pick the stage you want to play on. The music and the feel of it is very like JRPG, very Japanese RPG of the time, but it's Sega Bass Fishing. What do you think of it, Ravi? Because you're a big fan of like the Sega sports games for the Dreamcast, aren't you?
Yeah, I don't think it looks like a fishing rod. I think it looks like something else. But I think this is really cool. Like, I love the idea of these kind of, you know, companies that just didn't care. They pumped it out from another region, you know, put it out there and just blatantly ripped off a title. It does look cool. I'm a fan of fishing myself. I used to fish, and I need to get back out there. But now I can experience it at home.
Don't even need to leave the house now, Rev. Yeah. You can play a King Fishing on your NES, courtesy of a Pirate Game Thing. So very cool to see those getting dumped. Because that's the thing. I mean, you know, generally most of the big titles for the main systems are all kind of available to play, you know, in the main now. Kind of getting these unofficial ones, like I said, you know, those kind of crappy clone systems that you buy. It would be nice to have those preserved because they do bring back memories for a lot of people. So I think that's a very worthwhile effort. So you want to get hold of that. I'll link that up in the show notes as well. Now, just one final story before we hop into our chat with Alistair Lowe from Low Tech Games. And sorry, guys, I'm going to talk about the Commodore Plus 4 again.
There seems to be lots of Plus 4 news sneaking into the podcast, but I think it's probably because the scene is so active at the moment, actually.
Which is crazy, because, you know, the Plus 4 didn't get any love for decades. You know, I remember, like, you know, there was a couple of games kind of snuck out in the early 90s for it, generally, like, over in, like, Poland or Hungary, where it had a bit of a bigger scene. But, yeah, nothing over here in the UK that I can remember. But it does feel like in the last kind of 6 months, really, doesn't it? Like the Plus 4 is getting so much love from the indie scene. Particularly, it's kind of one team, I think, who are behind most of these. But this is another very impressive-looking port of a game to the Commodore Plus 4. And now, I mean, we had Outrun recently, which looked incredible. We've now got the great... Now, I'm going to say it wrong again because I always get comments on this. No one can agree on it. I always say the great Gianna sisters, but some people say Gianna.
Yeah, I say Gianna. Yeah.
I say Gianna. Solidarity. Well,
two against one.
I stand with
Gianna. There we go. we decide that's official now. But someone supported the great Gianna sisters, which was, I mean, if you don't remember that game, I'm sure most people do, it was a bit of a controversial game back in the day because it was basically a ripoff of Mario, wasn't it, that got yanked off the shelves. So that original version of it's very rare, isn't it, and very valuable if you've got one of those. But have you guys played, first of all, have you played the original Gianna Sisters before?
Oh, of course I have, yeah, definitely. Yeah. You know, and the music's absolutely banging. the music's a bit lower on the Plus 4 version, but there's still that scrolling in there, and that's the whole part of it. You know, it's as much as like Mario was a technical demo, you know, there was that whole thing about Id Software, you know, their first kind of product was... making a copy of Mario for MS-DOS to prove that the PC could do that side scrolling, and that works really well on the Plus 4 as well with this, doesn't it?
Yeah, which if you'd have told me that back in the day, I'd have been like, get out of here, no way. But someone's actually managed it. This is a bit of a miracle, really, because I mean, whenever we talk about these Plus 4 ports, I do have to remind everyone that, you know, the Commodore Plus 4, it didn't have dedicated SID hardware and it didn't have a dedicated sound chip, you know, because obviously the Commodore 64 version of this has got that incredible Chris Hulsbeck soundtrack on there, which is legendary, which I think they've actually done a pretty decent job of kind of recreating that on the Plus 4, bearing in mind its hardware. And again, I also said this guy's name wrong. C. Sabo. He's like one of the big Commodore Plus 4 musicians. He's done the music for this.
Interesting, the music, because you kind of have a cutout of when a sound effect happens, and the music, it's got this like kind of break, but it works, you know, and you get that consistent soundtrack throughout as well. So I can see there's a lot of trickery going on there.
Yeah, and this is Tamas Sasvari, who's done the programming here. M. Trends, who's done the artwork too. And this is, basically it's a really good port by the looks of it of Great Giana Sisters for the Commodore Plus 4. Now, looking at the intro, I mean, there is a video that I'll link up if you haven't got your Plus 4 emulator set up at the moment. It does really take advantage of, you know, the Plus 4 having more colours than the Commodore 64, I think. Yeah. Some of the intro graphics on here is incredible. But then the thing that made my jaw drop is when you get about, you check this video, you get about 1 minute 50 in, it is that scrolling, because it's got that scrolling introduction, hasn't it, with the title
that
goes along.
It's just really nice.
It looks incredible. And then when you get into the game, I've got a feeling, I mean, I haven't played the original Giana Sisters for a long time. And maybe, I don't know if you have, Joe, but kind of looking at this, it does feel a lot slower than the original Mario, for example.
Well, also, I used to remember people used to clone Mario on it. So they put Mario skins on it and there'd be all these pirated versions coming out. Yeah. So maybe we'll see, you know, a Mario skin on there at some point.
In terms of playability, though, it kind of feels like about maybe 25% slower than Mario, would you say?
I would say, about 25%. It's definitely slower and more floaty.
Yeah.
I would say. I've never actually played Giana Sisters, but Ravi always does say it's got a banging soundtrack, so I know that much about it. But yeah, watching this version of it, a little bit floaty. I think the original isn't quite as slow or floaty as this, is it?
No, I mean, that's the thing, and it's... I think the fact that they've got this running this well on the Commodore Plus 4 is testament to how skilled they are. And actually, for me, someone who's, you know, reactions maybe not quite what they were, having a slightly slower version, it's probably a good thing for me.
So, Dan, if you were a kid and you received your Plus 4 and received this as well, would you, have fuel for your playground arguments?
Oh, God, yeah. Because I remember, you know, all the kids at school, there was a few of them that got Plus 4s when they were selling them off like 99 quid, but very quickly most of them changed to Commodore 64s and then Amigas, and I would generally be a bit of a, you know, the laughing stock, the kid that still had a Commodore Plus 4 in 1991. If I'd outrun in Giana Sisters, though, I'd have thrown that back in those kids' faces.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm gonna have dreams about doing that tonight.
Yeah.
I'm going to have dreams about doing that to those bloody school kids tonight. So, the Plus 4, there you go. All along, it was a great system because of these great home ports. Shame we didn't get the love back in the day, but these do look awesome. The fact they're bringing these out for free as well. If you do want to download that, the website to check out is Plus 4 World, where they upload all of these for free. So great new port of Giana Sisters, and nice to see my first computer getting some love again. So I'll link that up in the show notes if you want to check it out. Right then, our special guest, massive indie developer, Low Tech Games, Alistair Lowe. He's coming up on the show in just a moment. Busy night for us guys tonight, because straight after this, we're going to be recording the next episode of our patrons-only podcast, because we do actually do an extra podcast each month called the Retro Hour After Hours. And we swap the theme up each month on the show, don't we?
Yeah, every month we do something different, whether that's kind of like we kind of review a year in gaming. We'll take a step back and review the year 1995 and talk about the games and systems that came out in that year. Or we might just kind of give our opinion on a system and kind of review the Super Nintendo and talk about our top five games for it, or the N64. Or what did we do last month? We did a really good one.
I think last month would have been, let me just check my list. I Can't Believe You've Never Played.
I Can't Believe You've Never Played. That one was really... We've done so many. We've done 40 episodes of the After Hours now, which is crazy. The next one, which I'm not going to spoil, is a little bit different. It's still retro, but not retro video games. A little bit different. But yeah, really, really, really love doing the After Hours. And we film it as well. So if you do want to watch it, it does go out to the patrons, level 2 and above. And if you do fancy watching it and looking at our mugs as well, Dan does a great job of putting some game footage in there and stuff like that as well. Yeah, it does look really, really good. So we do try to film it as well. But yeah, really excited to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, so that is going to be available this weekend for our Patreon Gold members and above. And of course, all our patrons, you get the normal podcast ad-free each week. We give you an extra 10 to 15 minutes of news stories. We've got a few more to talk about for our patrons exclusively in just a moment. I'll try and get the show out early if I can as well. And also get invited to our monthly patrons hangouts. So yeah, I mean, if you want to get invited to all the stuff we do for our patrons, we have a wonderful community, exclusive Discord channel as well. All the details to sign up right now are on the website at theretrohour.com. And of course, we do induct new members into the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, and that is the Retro Hour Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame!
And let's welcome in our newest members. A big thank you to Rodney Underkoffler,
Andreas Wander,
Tiago Apifano,
and James Randall, who all joined us on Patreon over the last couple of weeks. We massively appreciate your support. And if you'd like to join our wonderful Patreons community, sign up right now at theretrohour.com. Now, just before we hop into this week's interview with Alistair Lowe, let's take a second to give a massive thank you to a big supporter of the Retro Hour podcast, and that is our amazing friends at Shopify. You know the sound by now. That's the lovely sound of making another sale on Shopify. You guys doing any side hustles at the moment? Are you doing your retro gaming markets and stuff, Joe?
Retro gaming market. I'm usually there. Leeds, Doncaster, Birmingham. And that sound is a sound you definitely hear at the, not just the games markets, but Christmas markets. My wife went to a Disney market once where people who had like, you know, made kind of like their own businesses, you know, like Disney t-shirts, licensed t-shirts and jumpers and stuff like that. And you now see everywhere, if you kind of own a stall or run a stall like that, you have to have one of these, and they are the portable card machines. And Shopify do them as well. And they're excellent. They're really, really easy to use. You can just connect them to your app. And, you know, I was seeing these everywhere and I was like, I need to get myself one.
I've seen a few record fairs.
Yeah, record fairs, anything. Yeah. Wicked, aren't they?
Because no one carries cash anymore. Like, you know, particularly since the pandemic, it's like, yeah, no one carries money anywhere. So I think having these is essentially, you know, gone are the days where we used to, you know, before Play Expo, pull up to like a service station and withdraw like 300 quid and then worry that you're going to lose it all day. Obviously having these for your customers, these are shop ready point of sale systems, essential these days. And like I said, everyone's starting their own side hustle at the moment, maybe thinking of becoming your own boss. Shopify takes care of everything for you, not only in person, but also they offer a really comprehensive all-in-one commerce platform to run, start and grow your business as well. It is revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. So if you're selling in person or online, they've got everything you need. All your sales channels are covered. You've got the e-commerce platform, the shop ready point of sale system, and even they can help you sell across your social media marketplaces, stuff like Facebook, Instagram, even TikTok as well, with industry leading tools ready to ignite your growth, giving you complete control over your business and your brand. The best thing as well is you don't have to learn any new skills. Now, often with these platforms, you've got to learn like design or coding. None of that. Shopify take care of it all for you. And if you do get stuck, they've got award-winning help with extensive course libraries and 24-hour support as well. So they're ready to support your success every step of the way. So if you want to take your business to the next level and get serious about shopping and selling today, head to this website right now, because we want to give you an exclusive offer where you can try out Shopify for yourself for a £1 a month trial period. So head to our exclusive link, and of course the note that we sent you really helps out the podcast, shopify.co.uk/retrohour, all lowercase, shopify.co.uk/retrohour, to take your business to the next level today and get ready to hear a lot of this. Right then, time for this week's special guest, going inside the world of low-tech games with Alistair Lowe. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with Alistair Lowe of Low-Tech Games. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's great to have you on. And if you've heard the podcast before, you probably know our first question, which is, what was your first gaming experience?
Probably something on the NES, and probably Mario. Just Mario Brothers 1.
And then I did have, like, after that, like, every game ever, every game system.
Was the NES your first game system that you had?
Yeah, I think the NES was the first. And we got it at the car boot really cheap with, like, Mario and Duck Hunt and that kind of thing. We did have a ROB at one point as well, but it got robbed from us, got stolen.
Yes, and then there's irony.
Got a whole bunch of, like, hand-me-downs and stuff as well. So, like, Amigas and Sega Saturns and all that kind of stuff. Just buy everything cheap and just play what's available.
Were you always like a generation or two behind then?
Yeah, probably. But I also think I liked the older games better because they were more about gameplay than like effects or story. On the kind of puzzle side, I really liked Bill's Tomato Game and Lemmings, obviously. But Bill's Tomato Game always stuck with me because no one else remembered it of my era. And it was a bit like Choo Choo Mimic earlier, but a bit more rough around the edges, where you kind of like set out a like contraption of how to get a thing from one point to another point and then press play and then just let it play out. And I remember playing that lots and lots, but got really annoyed at the level design even back then.
It was a Psygnosis game, wasn't it? I do vaguely remember.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know about the whole game.
There was the Incredible Machine as well, which was quite similar to that, but that concept like got used a lot later on in titles.
Yeah, that was one I never played either. See, I just had whatever came with my Amiga, and it was hard to pick up Amiga games at the car boot. It was before I had the internet, so I couldn't download them.
Yeah, you didn't find the car boot piracy store then?
No, well, I got a bunch of people's collections that had the names written on a marker, but but it wasn't like going down the barras and there being a whole bunch of like pirate DVDs. They didn't have that for Amiga games where I was anyway.
Did you do any design work on there then, and did you start any coding yourself?
I remember spending a lot of time just using like the paint programs and stuff on there. Like the fill modes took ages to fill the screen. I remember that. And then there's that old thing of like, if you missed a pixel space, you would just see it fill through that pixel space and there's nothing you could do about it.
Yeah, the very leaky fills.
Yeah. But no, I didn't do any programming back then. I didn't know anywhere to start.
The interesting thing I like about your games as well is some of them aren't traditional games. And were there any like interactive kind of toys or anything that really caught your mind?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, anything that was weird and wonderful. I remember spending a lot of time on the VTech as well, like the drawing pad that had a whole bunch of games and just lots of drawing with an actual pen like on the screen tablet. Looking back, it was really, really unresponsive. But as a kid, you don't really care, do you?
Well, how did you transition from being a games player to designing games? And what was kind of that path that you went from, you know, to what made you want to start getting into designing games?
Yeah, I think I'd always wanted to do it. But I was going down the kind of movie route for a while because I liked like the art creation side of stuff. I was going to do like prosthetics and video editing, and then realized that prosthetics are really, really expensive. And I didn't have the budget for it, and then found some cheap or free software that let me do stuff, or some illegally acquired some other softwares. But the one I started in was the Games Factory. It's like a 2D pixel art style game. I think Click Team Fusion is what it is these days. It kind of evolved, but that gave me my grounding on how games work and like making your animations and adding the logic visually, but not code-wise, which was probably my downfall because I've not learned code that well because of all these nice visual editors I used when I was a kid. I had so many good things, and it was all kind of offline teaching. So it gave a whole bunch of examples that you could kind of tear apart and remake. And then there was like this quiz mode that quizzed you on specific parts of the software as well. And there was ways that you just press play and it simulates. And then whenever anything collides or you press a button, it flashes up and says, what do you want to do with this? And I just found it a really, really fast way to prototype stuff in a way that I've never found since. No other engine has did that. And even Click Team has removed that as a feature. It's a bit of a pain.
Well, you ended up working with Ninja Kiwi. How did you get involved with those guys?
I went to Abertay University and got quite a good mark and then applied really close to Handon's and just got the job. That's kind of how it happened. Hard work and good timing on that part. I'd never even heard of Ninja Kiwi before applying, like, whereas everybody else I knew had played Bloons at school. But I just hadn't found the Ninja Kiwi website on our school computers.
Yeah, Bloons is a really weird title, actually. It's kind of like one of those flash games from back in the days, and it's not the best looking game, but the gameplay is really, really strong with it. Could you explain the kind of concepts behind Bloons for our listeners?
Yeah, I suppose it's where the innovation was happening all the time back then, wasn't it? The kind of flash game stuff. So I wasn't really involved in it at that point, like creating the games at all. I came along at the end of BTD 4, which is Bloons Tower Defense 4. So they'd already had like Bloons, Bloons 2, Hot Air Bloons, and so many other Bloons games.
I think there was like 44 Bloons games, yeah, or something like that overall.
Yeah, I think there probably is, but they're on number 6 right now. And I did a look through once to see what domains they'd got, and they somehow had missed BTD8. Someone else bought that before they did.
That's crazy. Yeah, obviously a really long-running franchise. And obviously, I mean, a lot of those games back then, that era of the original Flash games was very experimental. I mean, did you kind of look at that and want to take that concept of Flash games to other systems, that experimental nature of them?
Yeah, I was really interested in watching the Flash games kind of make it into the mainstream and the consoles. Alien Hominid really had a place in my heart for... that was the first game I played when I got the internet in my house, and then the internet broke 10 minutes later. But I had that tab open, I could keep playing it. Just watching how that kind of transitioned to console and added more features and did really cool stuff was really fun to see. And I see, Fancy Pants is just getting its release finally on consoles and stuff. So that'll be really fun to play through.
Yeah, I love that kind of free-flowing nature of the early Flash titles. And one thing that you also worked on as well, you're dyslexic yourself, and I am as well, so this is close to my heart. Dyslextech as well. Could you tell us about that and how it improves the game for dyslexic users?
Yep. So Dyslextech came out of kind of necessity, because I was seeing people doing talks about being accessible for dyslexic people in games. And the only information that were given out was use this dyslexia font, this font made for dyslexic people that was kind of heavier at the bottom in line width. But I'd seen some places that it doesn't work very well. And in some people, it makes it worse. And there has been studies kind of proving this. So it works for some people, but definitely not for all. And that was the industry advice at the time. And I thought, I'm going to have to do something. So at first, I made a game highlighting the issues that dyslexics face, called Familiar Fairy Tale Dyslexic Text-Based Adventure. It basically simulates the frustration that comes with having to read. It muddles the text in weird ways and stuff. And then one of the accessibility features I had in that game was text-to-speech. And it's just the difference between like struggling through trying to decode the text and being able to understand the story. So then Dyslextech was the solution after that. I'd kind of highlighted the problem, and Dyslextech lets developers add text-to-speech to their games easily. As I could make it. But Unity moved on, and there's a few things that are kind of less compatible these days than when I published it at first.
Well, let's move on to a game that I'm sure many of our listeners have played. It's absolutely massive. Came out about, 4 years ago now, Flea, which is a fantastic retro 2D platformer. Very interestingly, also, you released that on the Nintendo NES, but of course it's available to play on Steam as well. So kind of tell us a bit about the background of Flea. What kind of gave you the inspiration to create that, and why did you want to do a game for the NES?
Yeah, I'm glad you like Flea and spoke very highly of it. I always wanted to make games for the NES, but it didn't happen until later when NES Maker kind of came along. But before that, I was working on stuff in kind of university in like 2012, 2013. I had came up with the idea of a character that just always jumped. This was before I knew of Doodle Jump as a concept, but I'd seen people playing Temple Run and stuff, and I like the idea of like Temple Run was automating your movement forwards and then you controlled your jumping. So I was like, let's flip that on its head and make it so you scroll the background underneath the character while he jumps. And that I did release a demo of that back in the day. It's still up on Itch, but you need an old phone to be able to play it because it's a different version of Android. And that concept finally turned into Flea Jump many, many years later, which is a fun infinite jumper game. But the reason it came to NES was definitely just because I was playing around with NES Maker, changed it to Always Jump, and thought that's like that old game. I'll go to that again. So it was definitely like design led first. And the reason it's a flea is because frogs and rabbits were kind of done to death already. And they're the other things that kind of jump. And I also like the idea that the fleas are like small and so are pixels. So you could like zoom out and then you could see the like a big high fidelity scene at some point.
Well, I mean, you mentioned that you used NES Maker as well. I mean, I guess that was really essential then to the project. And what do you admire about these, you know, these kind of suites that help you make, you know, develop games for retro systems? It must really make life a lot easier than I imagine, you know, when they're trying to do them back in the day. We've heard stories of, you know, people trying to make NES games on writing them out on graph paper and just then typing them into an interpreter. I guess it kind of changes the process quite a lot having these custom development tools.
Yeah, like Flea would not have happened on the NES if it wasn't for NES Maker. I'm just really happy that it happened and it was documented well enough to use. And the community was really, really helpful in kind of fixing any of the problems that I came across. Yeah, again, because I was used to kind of visual editors in general through my thing, so I'm not a coder very much. I definitely couldn't have did like the coding for a NES game myself. And then that kind of got me in the NES scene because people liked the design of Flea. And then through my audio guy on Flea, Tui, he's like one of the best now, whereas he was kind of just starting back at Flea, and he just cold called me on the forums one day. And I was like, yeah, I'll give you a go. You seem pretty cool. but he introduced me to the programmer for Tapeworm Disco Puzzle. And I like pitched him the idea of Tapeworm, and he like went off that night and made the first demo or like the first kind of playable something. And it was already fun. So we were like, yep, let's commit to a demo, and then we'll do a Kickstarter, and then if it gets funded, we'll go further with it.
That's great that you kind of made a connection over the forum and through the community, and then you know, made a project kind of come alive through that.
Yeah, I definitely had it lucky in that I found like really good people really quickly. If I'd kind of gone down a project route that failed somewhere along the way, I might not be where I am now.
I mean, 80 levels in Flea, that is a massive game, particularly for, you know, NES standards. How did you manage to maintain the balance in level designs and also keep them fresh as well? I imagine that must have been quite a challenge.
Yeah, 80 levels. It was 60 at first, and then the Kickstarter said a stretch goal for more levels, so I added an extra 20 and a dash move, which really, really helped. And I kind of wanted to do the dash move the whole way through. But the way I kind of do stuff is just make levels that are kind of fun, just in any order, just kind of exploring specific mechanics, and then play them all, and then make a big spreadsheet and rank them all, like hard, difficult, rage, and then kind of rearrange them in the right order, but kind of sprinkle in easy ones amongst the hard ones and hard ones amongst the easy ones. As long as there's not too many rage ones right next to each other, I think it's quite a good balance.
And it got funded in 3 days as well, which is mad. And I think you started it just as COVID struck. Did that actually help with you sitting at home and developing, I guess, being locked in?
Yeah, it was crazy that it went live 4 years ago, and halfway through it went into lockdown, and we didn't know how long it was going to be, but it definitely did help with development. It probably would not have shipped on time if it wasn't for COVID. There was a lot of late nights and weekends that I would have been busy otherwise, but wasn't because of COVID.
Sounds like you're more productive than most of us when we're doing Zoom quizzes for like 6 weeks.
Yeah.
I was just eating.
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty dedicated before anyway. Like I'd went over to New Zealand with Ninja Kiwi, and even then, like in my spare time, I was kind of dabbling away at Flea, still try to find all the fun and where it was and stuff. And it was structured really differently as well. It was almost Metroidvania-like at first, but I noticed that the NES Maker wasn't really built for that kind of game yet. So I just changed it to a kind of like what they called linear game. And I realized that I kind of don't like Metroidvanias that much either if they're not basically structured like a linear game.
Well, I mean, you mentioned, you know, Ravi said then it was funded in 3 days, which is just nuts. And I mean, were you blown away that there was that much demand for an NES title, or did you kind of anticipate that it might be on that level?
Yeah, you're always really scared when you go into a Kickstarter. You don't know what the response is going to be. So it was my first one I'd ever did, and there'd been another couple recently funded. So I had a good chance, but there was also three other NES Kickstarter games on at exactly the same time, which was less than ideal. I wonder if it would have got even more if it wasn't. But yeah, those 3 days were definitely nail-biting. I was like, is it ever going to get there? Because I had the tracking apps and stuff, and it was showing that they were going to be really good, and then it was kind of tailing off as the days were going on. Like, no. But I tried to make it sure that it could get funded on the early bird backers alone, which I think is a good strategy, because it feels that they're early investors, and if all of them go, you get over the line.
Well, it's interesting to see that you did a Dreamcast port as well, and I think the method that you used was really smart, because the Dreamcast homebrew scene was quite a big one, because, you know, early on they had boot CDs and yep. stuff like that. So how did you kind of go through that process of getting it directly onto the Dreamcast?
Yeah, so I had been like kind of watching all the homebrew scenes and seeing what ones were active and people were buying stuff for. And the main ones were NES and Dreamcast, mainly because you didn't need a modified system to play the homebrew for them. And then I remember a friend at school just gave me a burned CD that said like NES games and said, run that on your Dreamcast. So then years later, when I was making Flea, I was like, I wonder if I could port it to Dreamcast using that disc. And it turned out it was just an open source software thing called Nester DC. And had a license that we could use for commercial use. So we ported it over, added the VMU support, and just auto-boot into one game rather than having one of those horrible 90s menus. And yeah, made it available for everybody else to use as well. So there's been a few indie releases since then using NES. What do we call it? I just called it NES to DC, I think.
Yeah, so you've basically there, you've got NESmaker, which is this great piece of software for creating original titles for the NES. And then you can port that really easily on this new open sourced one straight to the Dreamcast. And it speeds up the whole process. And I guess it's now a development route that some people will actually consider.
Yeah, definitely. Annoyingly, the emulator itself doesn't support the native mapper type that we're using on NESmaker. NESmaker uses Mapper 30, which is a derivative of the Mapper 2 board back in the day. So it's like that, but it's got more memory and some more features. It's got like flash saving and some other stuff. It's not properly supported. You can like convert the ROM to be Mapper 2 that works in some emulators, and it just so happened that it did work in this, so it was kind of lucky there. But for Flea 2, it needs to update, because I've used some of the features that are only available in Mapper 30.
So you think there's going to be some updates to that NES to Dreamcast?
Yeah, which hopefully will just benefit the whole community again, because there's been a few people that messaged me about using it, and then their game was more of a like multi-session Metroidvania or something. And they were like, oh, so I just need to make it so you either a password system or you play the whole game in a one-er, which in the bigger games is definitely not the best idea.
You know, it is very heartwarming to see new games coming out on the Dreamcast, and there seems to be more and more of them all the time, which for, you know, what is generally considered, I suppose, a failed system, it's great to see how much support it gets from indie devs these days. I mean, what do you think kind of draws people to developing for the Dreamcast?
I think it's one of them's just because they see lots of other stuff already happening. That and because it is kind of big in a lot of people's hearts for being the kind of console that never got its shot. Plus, it's relatively easy to dev from what I've heard. In the 2D side, at least. I know Ross is doing the 3D stuff at the moment, and he's definitely banging his head off the wall and some of that stuff.
And I guess the process of getting a CD printed and all the kind of inlays and stuff is a bit easier than getting an actual cart for the NES.
yeah, the cost is so much lower. That's one of the reasons I did it as well. Just as the first run was just me. I sent away to a CD factory, but asked them to make the CDs blank so I could write them myself, because I didn't trust that they would do them without messing it up. And then that way I could verify everything. But it turns out the collecting community kind of frowns upon that kind of real homebrew style of stuff. They just have a bad taste in their mouth about burned discs.
Which makes sense to me, though, because I'd imagine, most CD printing factories probably don't have a Dreamcast on hand to test it on.
Yeah, I feel like you really needed to make a nuisance of yourself at one of these factories, and they could easily just tell you to go away. So I didn't want to risk that, and just kind of wanted to test the market, seeing if people would buy a NES game on the Dreamcast.
Well, I kind of love the whole thing with Flea. You did it on a leap year, and yeah. The idea is that you're kind of running in parts of it, so you're fleeing.
Yep.
Another pun was a tapeworm as well, which was your follow-on title. And what's the idea behind the game and kind of the absolute banging soundtrack as well?
Yeah, so most of my games are based on a pun in the first place. And then I'm like, right, how do I make the characters or the gameplay work around that? Tapeworm just happened to be a really cool character that people liked. And I was working on ideas for the playdate at the time, actually. I liked the idea that the worm was inside the cassette tape. You would move them down a path, and then you would use the crank to wind them back in the tape. And then we were going to build it for the playdate, but the SDK took way too long to arrive. So we just went ahead and built it on NES, because we heard that the playdate SDK could support C, and we could also build the NES game in C as well. So we built it kind of platform agnostic, so we could just swap out some of the rendering things and the stuff that didn't work on the playdate. And yeah, the tune, again, it was Tui. He did an amazing job on Flea. I just kind of asked for more of that. I gave a big spreadsheet of I want all these different club songs or whatever, but in Flea. And everything I asked for is, give me that, but itchy. Itchy and lumbering is usually what I say. Yeah, although Tapeworm was a bit more upbeat than Flea.
A disco puzzler, I heard it referred to.
Yeah. And weirdly, at first I was going to make it a rhythm style game, kind of like Cadence of Hyrule. What's the other one that was based on? Necrodancer.
Yeah.
But again, I played a bit more Necrodancer and realized that I didn't like that kind of movement. It felt really restrictive. And then when we were trying it in our game, it was really, really restrictive and just didn't feel fun. So it was within the first week, we cut that as a thing because it just wasn't working.
Yeah, fair enough. You don't know unless you try that, do you?
Yeah. And it was annoying because it was a nightmare to get set up as well.
Well, something else that is extremely impressive, and it is kind of a bit of a meme in the retro gaming scene today that Doom runs on literally anything.
Yeah.
But for people that haven't seen this this video, which I'll put in the show notes, tell us about cross-stitch Doom.
Yeah, cross-stitch Doom's weird. I like doing weird stuff, weird video game things. And I was making cross-stitch animation tool that let you kind of digitally animate cross-stitch, and then the benefit of that was that you would see the threads going in and out as it animated, and it leave this cool kind of ripple trail behind. And then one day in the park I was going to walk with a friend, and we were talking about it, and I was like, well, that could work in reality, and I had an idea of using some motors and some bits of thread to kind of pull bits of thread through that had different colored paint on them. And so then I made a really, really small prototype of a 2x2 cross stitch grid, and I could make it animate on and off. So I had a 2x2 pixel display made out of cross stitch, which is really, really cool. But to scale that was really, really difficult, so I didn't. But it was around the same time as April Fool's Day was coming up, and someone had already asked, does it run Doom? So I was like, this is the perfect opportunity for this. So I made a fake version of Doom using my cross-stitch animation tool, and then superimposed it over some actual cross-stitch in the real world, and made it look like I'd made it play Doom, which is really, really good, because we teamed up with the Scottish Games Network and some other random games news outlets to make it look like it was real. And they came up with a really cool thing. They called it multi-threaded. I thought that was genius.
Pun intended.
Yeah, definitely. And then, a whole bunch of people fell for it and reposted it, like Bethesda and id and Arduino.
Oh, wow.
And it was really great to see. And then the next day, like, I seen people defending me in the comments. They're like, this guy's a mad genius. They're like, no, it's fake. It's April Fool's Day. What do you expect? And then, yeah, a lot of my friends were like, you've did it to me again, haven't you, Ali? Because I always try to do something April Fool's Day and they always forget. And then some of the write-ups and on blog posts and stuff were removed after the fact because they felt bad that they'd been tricked.
Yeah, don't trust anything on April Fool's Day.
Yeah.
No, I love that. It's pretty cool with your titles as well, because you're getting onto lots of different platforms, not just cross stitch. Getting on Antstream, the Evercade as well, and there's a Switch version with the Parasite Pack. What's it like getting approval for all of these different devices, and is it a hard process porting for all these devices as well?
It's really good. I think the scattershot approach really worked for me, and Evercade specifically was really, really great at kind of publicizing Flea at the time, because it was COVID. Everybody was watching all the YouTube videos, and they put Flea kind of like front and center in the middle of that cartridge. I was very, very happy that happened. And then later for Antstream and stuff, I was just out at an event showing off the games, and Antstream were the kind of big sponsor at it. So I got talking to one of the guys there, and he says, well, we should bring you on. And I think I wasn't the first, but I was one of the first like new retro homebrews on there as well. And they really embraced it as well. So they put Flea on their banners and stuff. So like Flea's next to Pac-Man when they go to events. And again, it's boosting my brand and they're paying me to do it. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's always good. And then the Switch stuff, it's on like modern consoles, like everything from NES to PS5 is what I say. I just did that through a partner. Like everybody was trying to get stuff like NES Maker games onto modern consoles, and I heard whisperings that Rataleika had some emulation tech that was kind of just about ready to go. I don't know if it had been announced yet or not, but they said that they were working on the Turrican collection, and it was a multi-system emulator, and it could just run. Annoyingly, the interface feels very just bog standard emulator stuff. I asked them if we could kind of customize it and make it look nicer. They're like, nah, that's not in the budget. But
right,
but we just did it on a kind of split deal. So I just get paid for it being up there. Just get a little statement every month saying how much it's made, which is really cool to see.
It is great that you can get it on all these platforms, though, because I guess it's kind of removing the barriers, isn't it, to entry. People can play it whatever system they've got, which is definitely a good thing. And the Playdate system, I mean, we did kind of touch on that before. For people that might not be familiar with the Playdates, it's quite an interesting console. Tell us a bit about it and what appeals to you about it.
So yeah, the Playdate is a little yellow console that looks like a Game Boy. It's got a black and white screen that's not backlit, but it's really high pixel density and high refresh rate. It's got a crank on the side, which isn't used for powering it. It's used as an input device, and you can kind of interface with it in whatever way you want, which is really cool. So you can just think up. I just had a big spreadsheet again of all the ideas that could work with a crank, and the one with a worm was the one we stuck with at first. But I've made a whole bunch of other stuff on it as well. It's got a microphone and a gyroscope and Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. So it's a kind of modern device with a retro appeal.
And having these new input devices as well, I imagine that kind of changes game design as well, doesn't it? Makes you able to do all these different things that you couldn't normally do with a standard controller.
Yeah, definitely. And just combining it all together as well is really cool. So I made a few music apps on it. Because there was one guy who made this app called Franz Horn, and it's ridiculous. It's like you use the crank to extend this like brass instrument's horn section, and it sounds a bit like a theremin going back and forth. And I played with it so much, and I realized that it was like consistent in its weirdness. So I made a tablature system so I could play songs specifically and share them with other people to play as well. But from that, I was like, I want to make a band. So I made like a drum kit to start off with. And this was me learning Lua as well. So the kind of first time I touched Lua and kind of not visual code editing. The first time not using like an editor at all. It was just Visual Studio Code. And then what else did I make? I made an ocarina because I really like ocarina from Ocarina of Time days. Mm. I've got a big collection. So I sampled my favorite ocarina and then made what I think is a really cool system for a four hole on the D-pad and the A and B button. And then you blow into the microphone to kind of activate the, as if you're blowing on the ocarina.
Oh, nice.
And then the other one on the playdate, like if everybody kept talking about it, a hurdy-gurdy, just like a kind of bowed string instrument that has a crank that works as the bow. So I was like, right, that needs made. Someone's going to make it. I'm going to be the first. So I made a thing, and it's relatively playable, but it does need a little bit more work.
And another thing that you made that I saw that was absolutely fantastic was the light book as well. Are you planning on making that a proper product? And I saw online it had like millions of views.
And what is a light book as well?
Explain it.
Yeah, so the light book is a projection map pop-up book game system thing. We're trying to bring it to market at the moment. See, it has gone viral a few times. It went viral first in 2019. We got like 30,000 likes on Twitter. It was the first thing I'd ever seen that went viral that I had made. And then COVID happened. We got invited to a few things and we couldn't make it because of COVID. Then I applied for GDC a few years later. That was last year. They accepted it as one of the like kind of micro talks. So I worked on it then and like made it more portable and stuff because it was really quite prototypey in the first place. But you basically... there's a little projector about a foot away from this pop-up book. And when you change the pages, it detects what page you're on and changes like the layout of the platforms and stuff. And then there's a little platform game where you go pick up stuff and pick up keys and you interact with stuff on different pages from where you are. And then there's like a coloring in mode so you can paint the pages with color. Or there's a golf mode where you can shoot a golf ball around the same geometry. So you want as many ways to reuse the same book as possible. And the idea is to basically make a new console that is a projection mapping system that will work with pop-up books. And then each pop-up book will be its own kind of thing. And we just the licensing that we could get with that just excites me a lot.
It's a really hard concept to explain, but I think you've done it quite well considering this is audio only. But yeah, having that kind of turning of a page and then that idea that you can play on a page on a pop-up book,
video game is
insane. We're definitely going to have the video in the show notes for that one.
Yeah, definitely do. And in the like age of all this AR stuff, like the Apple Vision Pro and stuff, like those are so high-end headsets, like $4,000 a piece. We are hoping to be like sub £200.
Nice.
And it's a shared experience. Like not everybody needs a headset to be able to see it. So I think it's got legs to do pretty well in the sector.
Yeah, particularly like with parents and kids as well. I think, you know, that market, you know, it looks like you said, you know, wearing a headset, it's very isolating, isn't it? It's definitely just a one person experience generally.
Yeah. And people are always asking, can it have a like automatic page turner? It's like, that's not the point. It's good. It's good seeing the kids play it with their parents. Yeah. Like either one playing or one reading.
Yeah, it's like a, you know, it could be like a bedtime story, but
yeah, definitely
something that's not going to have like blue light that's going to keep the kid up with an iPad, you know, but still have that fun element and interactivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope it doesn't keep them too hyper. I've not did those tests yet. Let my niece play with it just before bedtime.
Yeah, to get the bad books with the parents.
You need a kind of therapeutic element to it. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you work collaboratively with another of our recent guests, actually, John Riggs of Rig Games. So how did you and John meet then?
Me and John, we'd talked online before because I'd sent him copies of Flea and Tapeworm, and he really liked Tapeworm. He likes the kind of puzzle games, and he played it a few times on his stream, and he always kind of like said it was one of his favourites whenever anybody asked him, which was really nice. And then I bumped into him at Midwest Gaming Classic, which I only went to because I realized it was the week after GDC and I was already in the US. So I was like, yep, I'll just stay an extra day, spend some time in Milwaukee. Don't do that. There's not much to do in Milwaukee. Sorry for anyone from Milwaukee, but you know. And then, yeah, so there was a whole bunch of like retro YouTubers around there and he came around, saw the book and instantly just picked up his phone and like started filming it. And was like, just tell me what you just told me again. Like, this is super cool. And I think at that point, he didn't even realize it was the tapeworm guy. He was just like, what is this book? This is amazing.
Right.
And then he posted it on Instagram and it got, I think it's sitting right now at 14 million views on that video.
That's some nice publicity.
Yeah. It was very, very good. I'm very, very grateful for that. So from that point, we were kind of talking back and forth and he pitched me the game idea. He said he was pitching it around a few other people. But I was like, I can't remember what he said. He was wanting to make a game about a mimic and that you would like set a route, like kind of puzzle game wise, and then get the knights to the mimic. And I was like, oh, so like Choo Choo Rocket? And he says, yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, let's do that. And then it went really, really quick again. I made a really quick design doc, teamed up with Aldir for it again. So it wasn't Nesmaker this time, was Straight C again, which meant that we could publish to Playdate. Because Tapeworm did pretty well on Playdate, so I wanted to kind of replicate that again on there.
So kind of, taking Choo Choo Rocket and it came out on the Dreamcast. What was it like, recreating that on the NES and essentially demaking the game?
Yeah, it was really good. See, I never want to make the same game, but just a demake. I always want to put kind of our own spin on it. And I did play a lot of Choo Choo Rocket at my after school club when I was a kid, and there was some elements that I was like, I wish it could do this or that, or this is a bit too restrictive. So it was really cool with that kind of thing. The really difficult bit, which I suppose turned into a positive in the end, was on the Dreamcast. It was really nice and straightforward. Your like directional buttons, your face buttons, did the directions that you were going to place the arrows, which made a lot of sense as a kid. But how do you do that on a controller that's only got two buttons rather than the four for the four directions? So we came up with the idea of just having like a palette up the top that had all the different things. You just select them with one button and you can delete them or like back out with the other button. And for the most part, I think it works pretty good. There was a Choo Choo Rocket game on the Game Boy Advanced as well, which was less successful, I think. It used some weird combinations of buttons to do it, even though you were still limited by the palette of arrows in the side, which was weird. But no, I was really happy with how it turned out. But then it also meant that we could do things that weren't just arrows. So we've also got springs and pushable blocks in Choo Choo Mimic, which do just add a whole bunch of like puzzle opportunities, especially the boxes, because we've got a few different knight types in each of them. They've all got their own kind of unique behaviors. Like one of them turns left when he hits a wall, the other one turns right. Another one can jump over holes, another one can push boxes. When you combine all of these together in the later levels, you've got like one knight pushing a box so that then the next knight can use it as a blocker to change its path, and it gets quite complex.
It felt like one of those games that, people could play on Twitch or something and have people going,
definitely.
Push people this,
helping out, like, put that one up, one over.
Well, you did touch on before that, Flea 2 is on the way. So give us kind of the lowdown on what people can expect from Flea 2. And is there any kind of exciting new features that you can mention already?
Yep. Flea 2 is on the way. So I was taking Flea around a whole bunch of conventions and people just seemed to really love it. I didn't want to do a direct sequel for a long time, but then people just kept asking for it. So I was like, yep, I'll do it. But it can't just be for the sake of it. It needs either to have the features that I wanted in Flea 1 that I had to cut, or just something special. So I found a way to do animated tiles in this, much like in Tapeworm, the blood pickups and stuff animate now. There's just so many like quality of life things that I wanted to fix in Flea 1, but they were like consistently annoying. So we got them all fixed. There's also this new ability that, again, I'd concepted for Flea 1 but never knew how to do, where you hold the A button and it kind of charges up this bubble around you, and then when you hit the ground with the bubble, it gives you like a double jump. So it mixes between like the mashing to get the small jump, the big double jump. And the mashing was a weird thing that I was taking it around conventions and stuff, and someone was like, this game's really easy, you just do this. And I didn't know that it was a thing. And it turned out to be one of the kind of key features of Flea that made it different from any other auto jumpers. And it was definitely just made from a bug that I didn't know how to fix. And I turned it into a feature, designed a whole bunch of levels that you have to jump less yeah, it feels weird at first, but you get used to it. And I think the kind of speedrunners quite like it.
Are you going with the initial NES launch, and then are you going to have support for other systems later?
Yeah, it's going to be NES primarily again, and then it will come out to Dreamcast and stuff later. So we still need to do edits to the Dreamcast emulator to make it work. And then we'll try to get to as many systems as we can in the future. There's some stretch goals for Switch and Playdate on the Kickstarter, but they are pretty high because the Playdate specifically needs to be like redone for it to work, because NES Maker doesn't. There's no emulator for the Playdate yet that runs NES games.
Well, if people do want to support it, I mean, it, by the time this podcast comes out, it should be live on Kickstarter. We're only planning on going live on 29th of February.
Yep.
So it should be available now. If people, you know, if you love the original Flea, you want more of it, you know, even bigger, even better. And obviously supporting indie devs who are making games for systems like the NES and the Dreamcast, I think, you know, it's really important that people get behind it, and especially quality titles like you're making, Alistair. So I'll link up the Kickstarter in the show notes as well. So best of luck with it all. We can't wait to see it.
Cool. Thanks for having me.